So now I'd like to proudly introduce Jack H. from San Jose.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jack Holt, an alcoholic.
Hi, Jack.
God, I'm glad to be here. You guys got any prayers left? Say them for me. But I'm up here by myself. That's all right. Great Scott. What a crowd. Beautiful, beautiful. I'd like to welcome the newcomers myself. You're a special group to us. All the new people. And all the old people, too, you know. But the new ones especially, you're among friends. You're among people with a deep understanding of your problem. If it's alcohol, and if it wasn't, I doubt if you'd be here. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic. And I can remember spending many years in countless vain attempts to control my alcohol and my drinking. Any of you remember doing that? So I did that, and naturally I wound up here. Anyone has to spend years of countless vain attempts trying to control their alcohol winds up in a place like this or worse, you know, because that's just how it is. I came here a long time ago. In fact, there's a couple of my babies here tonight. One of them said to me the other day, "You've been dry so damn long that you're a fire hazard." So I didn't have anything to say to that. I just brushed it off lightly. A little bit of what I used to be like. First 9 years of my life, I was stone sober. I didn't have a drink. And the first time I ever got drunk, I got drunk helping my dad bottle homebrew. I come from a family of Tennessee farmers. And from no alcoholics in it that I know of, I'm the only alcoholic in my family. However, you know, farmers do make alcoholics too, or alcoholics make farmers, I don't know which. But I'm here tonight to tell you that first 9 years of my life I was sober, and I didn't have another drink after that because I got too damn sick until I was 14 years old. And I was at a dance, and I was timid, and I was bashful, and I was all these kind of things that a young man is when he's 14 years old. So I had a couple of shots of white lightning. Anybody don't know what that is? That's Tennessee terrapin spit. So I had some of that, and I felt 10 feet wide and 20 feet tall. Things got to going then, and I'll tell you right now, I became a dancer. I never danced before in my life. I became a singer. I never sang before in my life. I became any damn thing you wanted me to be, and I've never been anything before in my life. That's what alcohol does to an alcoholic. So you know how early I was an alcoholic. So at the age of 15 years old, I was another one of these dances, some more of that white lightning from a different bootlegger. And I take two or three snorts of that, and I damn near died. I passed out right then and there. It was poison. And my dad come to get me because I was sick. I was dying. And he went and got the doctor. And the doctor came out, and they shoved and crammed pure lard down my throat till I vomited. That's how in the way they had to get it out of me, because they didn't have stomach pumps in those days. So I don't like grease till today, even right now. No use for it at all. The hell with it. You can take your lard and stick it. I don't want it. But it never occurred to me to stop drinking. Not once. I said, I will not drink any hard liquor for 6 months. I shall drink Tennessee homebrew. Well, you take a cork out of a bottle of Tennessee homebrew and blue smoke will curl in the air 4 feet. Four bottles of that. You're scratching your watch and winding your ass and wondering where you are. We're going to soar with the Eagles tonight, kids. Not going to be any of that sewer crap. We're going to ride to high places. See the good things. They're for us. You're damn right they are. So I drank Tennessee homebrew for 6 months and went back to hard liquor and both of them. Then I had two things to drink. That was worse. At the age of 18 years old, I went to my dad and said, "Dad, I'm going to join the Navy." He says, "Get the papers. I'll sign them." He didn't give me any argument at all. Because I had been an alcoholic then. I did all the things that you could do drinking. So I became a member of the Navy in 1939 on January the 25th. I went to Norfolk, Virginia. for boot camp. Anybody ever been to Norfolk, Virginia? I'll tell you right now, that's a hell of a place to be if you're a sailor. But by God, I'll tell you right now, in those days, they had signs all over the place. Sailors and dogs, stay off the grass. Well, being a sailor and a rebel, I got on the grass. And all I was born a rebel. I came into this world a rebel. I'm still a rebel, in spite of all the things that I've learned. So I became a member of the United States Navy, and I shipped around here to this great coast of California in 1939 and went to the World's Fair in 1939 on Treasure Island in San Francisco, and I was introduced to your wine that you make here in this country, and I found out you get just as drunk on that as anything else. So I'd have had three things to drink then. Christ, I was getting better, you know. So I was here for a year. I went to my executive office and said, "Sir, I'd like to transfer to China." He says, "The papers will be ready tomorrow." He didn't give me any argument at all. So in 1940, I landed in Hong Kong, China, the utopia of the alcoholic in those days. You could buy good booze at $1 a quart and bad booze at 50 cents a gallon. And some of that Sam Shoe whiskey that they pickle lizards in, you could get that for $4 for 15 gallons, I guess. I don't know. But anything. I used to buy that for my rickshaw kid. But at any rate, that was the way I was. And out there, I'll tell you right now, on the south coast of China, that was one hell of a place. Fight, raise hell, and drink, that's all we did. Discipline wasn't near as strict as it was here in the States. I went all the way into Peking, China. All the way. And Peking, China in those days, they used to call it Taiping, Peking, and all that. It was every nation had their Marine Corps there because the ambassadors were there. Well, the colonel of the United States Marine Corps was a head man. So we had liberty every night. So I would drink one night with the Axis and the next night with the Allies. So it didn't make any difference. We all got along just fine. Drunker than hell, you know. Russians, Japs, didn't make any difference. Chinamen. Next night I'd be with Englishmen, Irishmen, and Scotchmen and all that. You know, everybody drunk, raising hell, doing the same thing, you know. You see? Get rid of these goddamn politicians, wouldn't have any trouble. Turn all us people loose in the world. We won't fight. You'll find us loving, necking, breaking, racing hell, doing all those kinds. We won't be fighting. That's how we are. Especially the alcoholics. We might fight, but we don't really mean it. So I spent 2.5 years on the south coast of China and the Philippine Islands. And I was out there in the battles and all went on. I was out there when the war broke out. I fought under 3 different countries, 3 different flags, the United States, Great Britain, and Holland. And I could stand here tonight and tell you that my war record was the reason of my drinking, and that would be a damn lie, because I was safer in a sea battle than I was on a beach with a fifth of whiskey. Because I was the kind of a guy to walk off into dry docks with no water in them, looking for my ship. I said, "Where's the USS Gillespie?" The guy said, "You're standing under it." See? I got no business being here. I'm here on somebody else's time, God's time, not mine. I didn't do a damn thing about keeping me alive. But I'll tell you one thing, I'm sure glad I am. So I stayed out there until the war broke out. Like I said, I got back here to the States in 1942. And in those days, you know, they used to court-martial guys for taking a long time to travel short distances. That was my trouble. So I was court-martialed 3 times before I was 21 years old. Get drunk, you know, take me a long time to get somewhere. In fact, when we got back from China the first time, they said, "You boys are going to have 30 days leave. You're brave heroes." We got into San Francisco. They said, "Sorry, fellas, you're only going to have 5. Well, I had a resentment right there. So I went off on a drunk. Well, I managed to wind my way somehow down to San Jose. It took me 5 days to get down to San Jose and 5 days to get back to San Francisco. Why does that take to do that? So it long came a time, you know, and I had to get transferred to new construction. And they didn't ask me if I wanted to go. The executive said, "Holt." "Yes, sir." He says, "Your papers are ready. Get off of this ship." So I went to new construction out into Gold Island. Well, from San Francisco to Gold Island, it's right out in the middle of the bay. It took me 5 days to get around the bay to get there. A lot of bars along the way. A lot of people to talk to. So, they court-martialed for those kind of things. So I was court-martialed 3 times. The last court-martial, you know, the second time I was court-martialed, the captain called me down to his cabin. He says, "Holt, I want to talk to you like a father. Pull the shade down. You know what you do when somebody wants to talk to you like a father? You pull the shade down. You don't listen to him. So he talked to me like a father. But I remember him saying one thing. Hope, I want you to go ashore. I'm going to give you a 72-hour leave, liberty. I want you to go ashore in San Francisco. I want you to go down 3rd and Howard. So I want you to pay particular attention to people that are sleeping in the doorways and sleeping in the gutter with their head on the curb. That's where you're going to be before you're 25. I'm going to help put you there. You don't stop this drinking. I said, thank you, sir. Took the 3 days liberty, went ashore and got drunk. What the hell else do you do? Don't know where I went. I went back to ship the one time. On my trip to San Jose, I met a lady there. She was with me tonight, my wife Alice. We've been married 42 years. Some people said, how in the hell did you do that? I said, I'd be damned if I know. It's her fault, not mine. But I didn't want to leave her hanging out someplace. She's sitting right here in the front row watching me. In fact, there's a lot of people sitting in these front rows watching me. I got to be honest tonight, at least partially. We have developed something so-called functional dishonesty. You know, that's all right, I guess. So her and I, we met. And I convinced her that I was a $2 million tobacco plantation owner in the state of Tennessee. And asked her to marry me. And she did. Hell, I didn't have $15. I had to borrow $15 from her sister to get married. We drove all the way to Reno, well, halfway to Reno. Car broke up in San Francisco, in Sacramento, and we came up to Reno, and we were married here in Reno. And it was the first guy I got married that day, and they always gave a serviceman, the first guy married, they'd give it to his marriage license was free. So they married me for nothing. I got it hung together, though. 42 years. I'll tell you, that woman's a goddamn miracle. I don't know how. So anyway, I met her. So her and I got married. And, you know, during the war years, why so forth, I was away a lot. So we didn't fight a hell of a lot. I was away a lot. But then after the war, I got out of service in 1945. And went to work. And like all alcoholics, I worked hard and drank hard and played hard. And so I worked for another guy for a year and a half and decided he was making too much money on my labor, so he went to work for me. That sometimes isn't too good, you know, for an alcoholic to go to work for himself. But I did, and I made good dough. And the harder I worked, the more money I made, well, the more I drank, until finally it turned around the other way. The more money I made, the more I drank, the less I had, see? So finally, her and I, you know, we were sitting there, and my God, all this stuff was taking place. But she was a kind of a gal. She went along with me a lot. A lot of ways she didn't. But I go home at night, and I remember I went home one night, and I was standing. I was the kind of a guy, when I got drunk, I could walk forward. I never staggered sideways, but I'd run backwards for 3 miles, you know. I don't know why. Everything was tilted backwards. And I could walk around for hours and never know where in the hell I was, like a zombie. I went home one night, and I was standing, you know, my thumb up on the doorbell and my head up on the screen door. Passed out right there in that position. So I gets up the next morning. I went and looked at the mirror, and I says, "Damn it! I got the measles. I had all these little tiny pimples all over my head." I said, "Honey, I got them damn measles again. You haven't got the measles. I hit you through that screen door last night." Down the stairs I went. I guess rolled out the lawn. But she loved me, you know. And I go home and I lay back in my big chair and I cross my feet. You know, we have shoelaces in those days. She'd tie my shoelaces together, give me the hot foot with these big old wooden matches. I'd come out of that chair and I'd tear up all the furniture in the goddamn living room. Coffee tables would be splintered. I'd have bruises all over them. I said, "What the hell happened last night?" She said, "You fell down." But like I say, you know, she loved me. Yeah. She damn near killed me, though. I always had bruises all over me. She didn't have any. But at any rate, as the pain went on, this drinking went on, I got meaner and I got bigger and I got meaner and I got tougher. I got everything. God damn it, you know, I tell them I'd go home, I'd tell them, "Now, you leave. Take these kids and get the hell out of here." So we had two, a boy and a girl. Because you know something, when a guy gets big and he's mean, he's getting into his last stages of his drinking, his wife and his kids got no business at the house. So I didn't like drinking alone too much in those days. I always liked to have people around, at least somebody with me. So I had a parakeet called Petey. And Petey, You know, he loved bourbon. One day I let him have a sip of bourbon. And by God, you know, he was like me the first shot I ever had. Man, he just ruffled up and became a real hero. So he'd start, I'd sit down, I'd sit there, jigger of whiskey on the dining room table. He'd drink out of the jigger, and I'd drink out of the bottle. Well, Pete and I'd get on these big drunks together. But he was quite a linguist, though. He used to hang over at my poker table. He learned all the languages of the drunken poker game, you know. Son of a bitch, bastard, raise, tie, ten, flush, and all this kind of stuff. Some of the stuff he learned, I won't even repeat here tonight. But he and I drank together. And one day, you know, he was passed out on the floor, and I stepped on him. And I weighed 250 pounds. 240 pounds. Take that back. You always stretch a little bit when you get older or something. 240 pounds. And old Petey was as flat as a pancake. I said, thank God, you know, I've killed my best friend. And I was crying. I remember I picked him up, and I was petting him and crying. I said, Petey, what's the matter? Come on, buddy. I took him over, and I set him down on the table about 12 inches from that jigger of whiskey. And goddamn, he began to fluff up a little bit. Hey, he went over there. Got a couple of snorts out of that jigger of whiskey, you know, and around the room he went, you know, flying. You know? And he'd take three or four drinks, you know, and he'd get real amorous, and he'd start chasing a female dog. I had a female dog. When Alice and the kids was out of the house, that dog hit on the bed all the time with old Petey. He was hornier than hell all the time, going around and chasing that dog all the time. He was a real alkie. And I loved him. And he loved me. And we drank together, we raised hell together, and I'm telling you right now, we had some of the damnedest parties you ever seen. You got to be pretty damn sick to drink with birds. Even drunks don't do that most of the time. I want to tell this right now. Petey died with 2 years sobriety. So we'll go on. We go on. He's in the early 50s. Disease getting worse. The disease getting worse. The disease progressing. Me getting sicker. My wife getting madder. Feud out the attorney all the time, trying to get divorced. I said, I'm not going to sign them damn papers to get divorced. Well, the attorney, he'd call me up, you know, say, Jack, don't come down and sign the papers. I wondered why. I never did know until after I sobered up. And his wife had died in the bed drunk in Honolulu. And this attorney of ours kept us together. Because he never, never tried to get me to sign those papers. I never knew this until after I sobered up. But Alice would go down and just ranting and raving, you know, get them damn divorce papers going. And, you know, and John would say, Jack, you don't have to sign them. We never knew this till after sobered up. His wife had died. She was an alcoholic. See, so many things, you never know where help's going to come from. So on the drinking went, though, after that. But I never did get divorced. We never did get divorced. She stayed with me. She damn near killed me, but she stayed with me. See, I wasn't leaving all the time. I never was one to leave home. I was kind of go to my house and say, God damn it, this is my house. You get out, you know. That's kind of an egotistical idiot I was. Here, I no wonder why I had so many bruises. That was why. She said, well, I'm not leaving. But then when I got mean and all this kind of stuff, she said, I can remember sitting in my house in my big chair. And I can remember shadows passing through that house, talking to me. And I'd talk back. I couldn't find anybody. I remember music playing. No radios on or TVs on. But it was all playing anyway. And I was having a party in there, me and that damn bird. All by herself. Nothing on, but this weird thing going on in my head. So as I went on, this program, the disease getting worse and worse all the time. But I wasn't paying any attention to that. It seemed to me like I was just getting better. I guess I was passed out more. But goddamn, you know, after a while you begin to kind of wonder. So it was on in 1950, early 50s, why these things was going on, you know, and so I can remember as Petey and I drank and I got sicker. I can remember in 1957, on March the 17th, St. Patrick's Day, I came to. And I had a horse by the leg, hollering, "Whoa, you son of a bitch! Hold him by the leg!" And I had a piano by the leg. I was laying on the piano, and that horse was trying to stop me to death. I had that piano by the leg. No clothes on, Petey laying over on the floor, passed out, high dog hiding on the bed. That was our routine, you know. Petey and I passed out, and the dog hiding under the bed. I was the kids out in the motel. I paid a lot of motel bills in those days. But then, the phone rang. The voice on the other end of the line says, "How you feel?" You know, kind of persnickety. Quiet. It kind of drives you nuts. I says, "Not too damn good." He says, "How you like to do something about your drinking?" I said, "Well, I'd like to do a little something about it, but not too drastic." So on March 17, 1957, a man came over to my house, picked me up, and we went down. We talked to another man from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to my first AA meeting. St. Patrick's Day, 1957. I remember going into that meeting that night. Oh, I'll tell the story about my sponsor. The guy that picked me up was my sponsor, Al Lee. And I made a call on him 6 years prior because he had called me up. He and I was drinking together and building together and doing work together and doing business together. He called me up to come over to his house, talk to him about his drinking. So I did. Went over there, me and a drunken lawyer, red nose, you know, fellow by the name of Bean. Went over to this guy's house, Al, my sponsor's house, to talk to him about his drinking. So I told him, I said, "Al," and this guy, Bean, says, "Well, you could call AA. You know, those boys do you pretty good sometimes." I said, "Al, that's too damn drastic. You know, those bastards don't drink at all." "Now, that you want to do that." I sat there and drank his whiskey and told him he should, you know, he should cool it. Did not go that far, but he did. He went to Alcoholics Anonymous on that day. That I went over to his house 6 years prior. And he didn't have had another drink. And he's still over 33 years right now. Coming upon 34. So I went to his house to listen to him, but that's how this thing works. But when he came over to talk to me, I was all different. "Well, I'll go with you." I had some booze to drink, so I drank some. I couldn't go down to that bunch of drunks, you know, stone sober. After all, felt like I was lowering myself, you know. Pompous ass. So I went to my first meeting. I went to that meeting that night, and I met a guy that I knew. He knew me, but we didn't know we was alcoholics, either one of us. He was chairing the meeting. So I heard him say one thing that night. He said, "If nothing else, stay sober 90 days and you'll save enough money to get on a good drunk." I said, "Sounds just right." You know, just exactly right. So I went back and I, through goddamn willpower and absolute, I stayed sober 90 days, dry. And on the 91st day, I drove to Salinas to tell Al, my sponsor, "By God, Al, I never have been an alcoholic. I never will be, and to hell with it. I'm going to quit this damned outfit." And I spent 2 hours telling him why I wasn't an alcoholic. And after that, he said, "Well, Jack, if that's the way you really feel about it, just step over there to that bar across the street and try some controlled drinking." I said, "Thank you, Al." And I did. Of course, on the way home, I hit a car. That's how fast you get going, you know. So, I was back out on the streets I went. And I stayed out there for 9 months. Now, old Petey was happy because I had him shut off, you know. He had a big resentment while he was dry. But he was happier than hell. Back again drinking, you know, me and him. Him on the floor and the dog hiding on the bed. All that stuff, come back again, you know. And these strange people coming through my living room. All things going on, yelling at him, hollering. All this stuff going on again. Sick, sick, sick. So, that's the way it was. I drank, and I drank, and I drank, And I never did any harder drinking in my life. It seemed like I was trying to catch up for those 90 days, trying to make up for them. I controlled it a little bit for about the first 60 days. But you know something? After that, it seemed like everything went to hell in the handbasket. God darn, everything went bad. I remember turning off of San Carlos Street, left onto my street. The guy had his car parked in front of his house. I pushed it right up on his front porch. I never did straighten out. I just kept turning, you know, all around. 360 degrees. Never has been a car parked on that street since, in that corner. I drove a car over a cliff in Mexico. I've crawled out of 3 wrecks, total wrecks in my life, and I got no business being here tonight. I've done all those kind of things that alcoholics do. Wrecked cars, did all this kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, that 9 months I spent out there drinking, that was the most terrible goddamn time I ever spent in my life. It was absolutely just sick. Sick. So on March the 5th of 1958, I came to on a bar stool. I came to, and I was sitting there, you know, and everything was just as clear as a bell. Now, I don't know why everything got clear as a bell. I didn't know then, but I know now. Now, I turned to the guy sitting next to me. I said, "Charlie, this is my last drink. I'm going back to AA." He says, "By God, I'm going with you, Jack," because he'd been with me on that drunk, you know. He was sick. So on March the 5th, I went in, I got up, and I went in, and I called up this guy in AA. I said, "Hey, I want to go to an AA meeting." I didn't know it was 10 o'clock at night. He said, "Jack, there's no meeting at 10 o'clock at night, and besides that, you haven't finished your drunk. After all, you're still at the bar. Go ahead and finish it now. Get it over with." But I had. And I called my wife, Alice, says, "Come get me," and she did. Went over to my sponsor's house, you know, crying, slobbering. You know how an old slob is. He said, "Well, what the hell? Just come on back. No problem." So on March the 6th, 1958, I returned to Alcoholics Anonymous. 4 of us. There was 4 guys followed me into AA that time. I didn't know I had that much power over them. But you know how. So 4 of us and 4 sponsors walked into the old Prune Ridge meeting, still going on today. We walked in there like a squad of soldiers. 4 little babies. Drunker than hell. Sick. But I had my last drink on March the 5th, 1958. So my birthday is March the 6th, 1958. That's my birthday. But I heard different things that night. I heard things like, "If you never take the first drink, you'll never get drunk." And I said, "Well, I'll be damned." Who in the hell ever heard of that? Any idiot would know that. But I'd lived 38 years and hadn't found it out yet. And spent 90 days in AA. Because my first 90 days, I hid behind a post, didn't talk, wouldn't read, wouldn't do, go to one meeting a week, and sit there with my ears closed. But I heard different things. I heard these guys talking about, "If you never take the first drink, you'll never get drunk." I heard them say, "You only have to do it a day at a time." And I heard them talk about all these kind of things. First things first, and easy does it. And he says, "Participate, get busy." I said, "Go to meetings every day, every night." I did. I said, "Okay, I'm going to give this thing a real try." So I started going to meetings every night. I had 2 weeks in the program, got my first 12-step call. And this guy was laying on Vine Street down in San Jose, and he was down in the basement, in the apartment basement. Well, it was just a room down there on the concrete floor. All he had was a wash tray. He was laying down on the couch. His head was hanging off the couch. His tongue was hanging out of the side of his mouth. His eyes were wide open, staring at the ceiling, glazed. I said, "This guy's dead. Hell, he's not drunk." But I went over and I could hear his heartbeat. So I picked him up because he stunk so bad I couldn't stand him. And I took him up and I put him down in this wash tray and turned the water on him. Wash him off because he stunk so bad, you know, he'd let go from everything. So I stick him out of that wash tray and slung him over my shoulder and took him home with me. Walked through the front door and said, "Honey, I got a sick one." She says, "Phew, you sure have." She said, "Take his clothes off of him, take him in the bathroom, set him in the tub, and I'll wash his clothes." So, by God, I did. Went back out, you know, sitting in the living room, and this guy was in there soaking. In about 30 minutes, you know, a thought just seemed to hit me upside the head. Something's wrong. Bing, you know. I go in there and I look, and here he is. Water lapping right up here, you know. Foam pouring out of his mouth. I looked down alongside of the tub, and there was an empty bottle of rubbing alcohol, that Skull and Crossbones one. He drank the whole damn thing in a half an hour. I said, by God, he's dead this time, for sure. So I pick him up, throw him over my shoulder, throw a blanket over his naked butt, and head for the doctor. Run into the doctor's office, and I said, Doc, this guy's dying. He said, what makes you think so? He said, it's this empty bottle here. Hell, he drank the whole thing. He said, oh, hell, he could drink a gallon of that. What else you been drinking, Johnny? He knew him. And Johnny said, I've been drinking shampoo. Shampoo and blowing bubbles, you know. Here, I thought he was dying. So I said, well, by God, I'll start a vendetta right now. I'm going to sober you up if it kills you, man. You know something? I will protest him 10 months. And he's in San Francisco jail right now for drinking. But boy, he taught me a lot. I'm telling you. During his time, he taught me a lot. The last time Johnny called me, I went and got him, took him home with me, and threw him in my swimming pool in January with no heat in it. And every time he'd come up, I'd shove him back under. And I'd shove him back under. When he turned blue, I pulled him out. I took him in, I set him on the couch. I said, now, by God, you stay there. He said, I'm going to get out of this damn place. I ain't going to stay here long. So I went and I got my 30-06 deer rifle. I said, Johnny, if you cross that back fence, I'm going to blow both your damn legs off. You stay on that couch. He stayed there 3 days. He said, can I go now? I said, yes. He's never called me again. That was my first 12-step call. During that time that I was working with him, though, you know, why, I was beginning, you know, I said, well, hell, I'll just go out and make 12-step calls. That's all you got to do. So, hell, I was out making another 12-step calls. I made a 12-step call on a tile setter in Santa Clara. And he was out trying to shoot his wife with a 12-gauge shotgun. He was out, you know, this is way back in those days. Now, we had prune orchards. She was running through the prune orchard, and he was behind her. Blooey, 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 you know, blowing all the prunes off the trees. So I caught the little bastard, you know. Took the gun away from him. Called Alice, said, what the hell am I going to do with this wife and 5 kids out here? He said, bring them home, bring them home. Hell, I had alcoholics all over the place. In the bathtub, out in the patio, in the front yard, in the backyard, everywhere. But boy, we was mobiling. I'm telling you, goddamn. I was all going to taking them to meetings at night in my pickup truck. They was getting drunk. Had 6 months in the program. I was standing up in the meeting on Thursday night again, tears running down my eyes, and I was telling this sorrowful story of what a lousy sponsor I was. And boy, I mean, I was crying. When I got through with this 5-minute tearjerker, every damn one of them was drunk, and I was telling everybody what a lousy sponsor I was. When I got all through and sat down, a little man got up in the back, says, I don't know who in the hell you think you are. Says, you're not God. You can't get anybody sober, and you can't keep anybody sober. But you missed the whole point of this program, you idiot. You stayed sober. And I said, I'll be damned. Sure did. Said, that's what it is. That's what it goes. So I kept right on, 12-stepping. Right on, 12-stepping. The hell with those 12. Got to go 12 more. That's what you do. One gets drunk, we'll get two more. You want to know how to grow fast in this program? Get a whole bunch of babies. They keep asking you questions. You got to go find out. So I've always been a 12-stepper. So I had 12 babies. They was all drunk, but I was sober. But that made no difference now. I knew what was happening. I knew why I was sober. These guys had kept me so damn busy, I didn't even have time to drink. And that was good. That was good. That was good for me. Because, see, I was an egotistical son of a gun. I'll tell you. Proud, egotistical rebel. You know, nothing like a southern gentleman with a rebel. Shit. Might not know where I was, but I was a gentleman. That's it. But anyway, I kept on 12-stepping. And as I piled these guys up, I don't know how many babies I got. I wouldn't even stop to count. I really don't. Doesn't make any difference. What I'm really thankful for, though, is that they were all there when I needed them. So as I 12-stepped and kept on in this program, it was on now, I remember my second birthday. I went running into this little guy in Newt's house that told me I wasn't God. I said, Newt, today I've been sober 2 years. He says, so what? So's my damn cat laying over on the floor. Point. Hell of a guy, really. Here he was. He was 4.5 feet tall, I think. He used to be a Catholic priest, Jesuit at that. And they threw him out of the priesthood for being a drunk, you know. So he used to talk to me. And he talked to me, and he was sick in a wheelchair with emphysema. So I couldn't hit him. I weighed 250 pounds. I weighed more in this damn wheelchair and this old lady and everything else put together. But he'd say those things to me. Shut up and listen. Sit down. I invited him to my house when I was on him. I knew him about a month. In my living room, I said, and I started telling him my story. He said, nobody wants to listen to your crap. Shut up and listen. But on this date, I had 2 years. I did. I sat down and I listened. He started talking to me about things. He started talking to me about our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Jack says, you know, this is the greatest program that's ever been written for mankind. And I said, you're right, as far as I knew at that time. He started talking to me about things called self-honesty and different things like this. And he told me, he says, you know, Jack, if you want the program, you've got to go to the book. Nobody can give it to you. You've got to go to the book and get it. So he talked to me for about 4 hours that afternoon about our book, about our program. And he piqued my interest in this book. So I went home and I started studying this book. This book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the more I studied it, the more interesting it got. And if you haven't studied, it's about time you started. Because it is the program. And some of those things that I learned out of this big book, I'm going to show you tonight. One of the first things that I learned was on page 25. And it's called pride. Anybody here having a problem with pride? It says in there, you know, there is a solution. And the solution is, and none of us like it, the solution is a leveling of the pride. Don't say kill it or destroy it, it says level it. Well, how in the hell do you level your pride? Well, just ask yourself two questions sometime. Where has pride caused me to do things I didn't want to do? And where has pride kept me from doing things that I should do? That covered my whole damn life. Pride is something that's caused me more trouble in my life than any other, or all other things put together. Why do you think an alcoholic says, hell, I'm not going to give up drinking? You mean because you're so damn smart, we know that. No. Even though we are intelligent people, we wonder why, though. But it says that in there. But it says, if you will level your pride, which means you don't let it drive you up the wall any longer. You drive it up the wall. We said, if you level your pride, then you will be rocketed into a fourth dimension of living that you never knew existed. That I can testify to. Because I've been living in it. Every once in a while I run out of it. I get back into it pretty quick. But this is all on page 25 in chapter 2 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So one thing, unless we learn it, it says, this is required for the successful consummation of the rest of this program. Well, I don't know about you, but required to me means must. Now, you're here in AA, we got no must in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm going to tell you right now, we got some damn well betters. Now, I'm going to tell you, you better get on them. And on chapter 3, more about alcoholism. You learn. You meet yourself right there. You write eyeball to eyeball that drunk, that alcoholic. And you wonder, said, how come I didn't follow this damn thing into the gates of insanity or death? Why? Why are some of us picked? Why are some of us chosen? Why are some of us here tonight and millions out there and countless others are not? I don't know. Don't ask me that. That's God's business. But we're here. In chapter 4, The old agnostics. They taught us on page 25. Or page 55. They taught us. They teach us right there. They said they could get all the way up to the shore, but they couldn't get out of the boat until they looked deeper than themselves and they found this thing.
Please turn to side two of this cassette to continue the program.
But they couldn't get out of the boat until they looked deeper than themselves and they found this thing. And they called it the great reality. They called God. Called the great reality. Means God, but they couldn't use God. They were agnostics. So they found this thing called the great reality. And when they got in touch with that, see, they got to where they couldn't trust their own logic, they couldn't trust their own reasoning. So when you can't trust those two things, then you got to go someplace else. So you look deeper than ourselves. We find this thing called God, this great reality. The difference between getting in touch with that and not getting in touch with that is just like having a television set not plugged in and one that is plugged in. That's the difference. In chapter 5 it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly followed our path. It doesn't say paths. It's not plural. It just says path. Path. Now you know, they build highways across this great nation of ours from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean. Some of them are 8 lanes wide. And that's the easy, softer way to get across this country. But not the alcoholic. Hell no. Got to be another way. So down in the gulches we are, down in the briar patches. Looking for another way. One of my babies called me 5 years ago and says, "Sponsor?" "Yes, sir." He says, "You know, somebody wrote this damn book 45 years ago. And it's out of date." I said, "I'll see you when you get back." So he did the only thing an alky does, you know, when he says the book's out of date, he goes and gets drunk, trying to change it. Well, there we are, down in the gulches, down in the briar patches, brain at the moon like a jackass, you know. Gotta be another way, gotta be another way. Can't accept this one that's here, you know. The one that's been proven. The one that we know works. Not too long ago, one of the guys, I'm not his sponsor, but he called me and says, "Hey, Jack, my program isn't working." I said, "Who in hell ever told you your damn stupid program would ever work?" He said, "Your program won't work. Why don't you try the program, the one that works for everybody? Your program and my program ain't work a tinker's damn. You listen to my program, I'll tell you right now, you get drunk in hell." Because I'm a proud, egotistical, vain alcoholic. The program, the one that's in the book. And I always tell my babies, read the black lines. The black letters. Don't read those white ones in the middle. Those damn things are anemic. They got no power at all. Read the black lines. Where it says there's only two kinds of people that come here that do not succeed in this program. And they're the ones who cannot accept these simple teachings or the ones who will not. Right there you got to make a decision or you're a blabbering idiot or an egotistical jackass. But if you're smart, if you're a blabbering idiot, if you're a cannot, goddammit, I don't know what the hell we can do for you. But if you're a blabbering idiot, I know. Egotistical jackass, that's what we are. Or I am. I could carry that a little further, but I won't. But it's the only two kinds of people that the book talks about to come here that doesn't make this program successfully. The cannots or the will nots. Where do you want to be? A cannot or a will not? Make up your mind. Easy. Then he goes on to say, you know, that some of us come here even though we have grave emotional and mental disorders. You can be a damn nut and stay sober. And I'll tell you right now, you got to be a nut to be an alcoholic. We're not noted for our... I don't know what, but... Isn't it funny? We don't mind being called nuts, but nobody, we don't want nobody to call us crazy. Nuts is fine. That's okay. One day I was reading this first page on chapter 5, and a little word jumped off of this page at me. Little word, little two-letter word called it. I said, God damn it. If you have decided you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, there's a little hyphen right there. What the hell's it? Well, they don't tell you any more about it. So I started on a search for it. God, what a search that's been. 4 years ago, a young lady called me one night on my phone at home. She said, Mr. Hope, I said, yes. She says, have you found it? I said, yes. She says, how? She says, how come you found it? Well, you belong to a member of our church? I said, no. She said, well, have you seen these bumper stickers? Have you found it? Some of you probably seen them. Okay. So I says, no. She said, well, how did you find it? We only been here just a few years. I said, well, we found it. I found it 19 years ago. 19 years ago. Where at? I said, in AA. We couldn't wait for you guys. It's too damn slow. But a little word like it. If you have decided you want what we have, not if you want what we have, you know, we could place 20 drunks right up here in the row, right in front of us. And I don't know how many is in here tonight, maybe 500, 600, 700, I don't know how many. Doesn't make any difference. We stand up here, everyone will stand up in our chair and says, we have decided it is time for you to stay sober and quit drinking. Wouldn't mean a damn thing, would it? Until he decides, or she decides. If you have decided you want what we have, not if you want it. Hell, there's millions that want it. But you got to make that decision. If you decided you want what we have, you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Anybody in here balking at the steps? And some of these we balked, it says. Great Scott. Hell, that's the alcoholic's pastime. When we first come here, I came here, I was called a two-stepper. First step and a 12-step, and everything in the middle was somebody else, not me. Really? I'm not kidding you. Till that old man got a hold of me that told me, you know, so his damn cat's sober over there on the floor. But that's what happens. Then you go on in the book, says, you know, many of us try to hold on to our old ideas. Anybody here trying to hang on to your old ideas? Huh? That's what you're talking about, balking the steps to. Hang on to your old ideas. That one has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. We stood the turning point. God Almighty, how many times did an alcoholic stood the turning point? But that one important time, he stands at that turning point and says, I'm going to go. I'm going to go with the sober ones for a change. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. That means, by jingoes, you let her go. You know, when you let her go, that's when it starts working. The first step says, admit we were powerless over alcohol. Our life had become unmanageable. Admit it, I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, if you admit you're powerless over alcohol, if you admit you're powerless over anything, you're not very apt to go out and attack it. If there's a goddamn female polar bear out there in that foyer, I'll be damned if I'm going out and attacking her if I know who she is. I ain't going out and try to rape her, I'll tell you that. Unless I was drunk, I might. But we're sober. And when you try to rape that polar bear when you're sober, I'll tell you right now, it don't work. Admit we're powerless over alcohol. That separates the men from the boys damn quick. Don't say anything about being an alcoholic. Alcoholic is a label. I used to sit on a bar stool. If you was an Indian chief, I was an Indian chief. If you was a doctor, I knew something about doctoring. If you was a horse wrangler, I knew something about cowboying. It didn't make any difference. But when you admit you're powerless over alcohol, you admit that, and your life has become unmanageable. I used to look at the word life and I'd say, God Almighty, what is that? So one day I got smart and I looked in the dictionary. You know what life says in the dictionary? You know the definition of life is thought. My thinking had become unmanageable. Simple. Anybody in here that think their thinking is manageable when they're drinking, huh? Do you? You do? Well, hell, you're in shape, bad shape. So the first step, admit I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is becoming... But you see, the reason why it's hard to do that is because it's hard to admit something like that. For the egotistical, proud, vain alcoholic. No, we're like General Custer. You know, an alcoholic, I tell you, I just get the damnedest kick out of this, but I can just see myself. You've heard of the four horsemen in the big book. Frustration, I don't know what the hell the other three are. One's fear, frustration, whatever they are. I can't memorize them all. But at any rate, you know what the four horsemen are. Okay, an alcoholic. Anybody else will ride one horse at a time, but not now. You see us coming down the road on all four horses at once. No saddles on them, you know. My God, just going straight, eyes blazing, you know, alcohol, his eyes, fire's coming out of his nose. He's got his saber headed out like General Custer. Charge! All the way. That's the way an alcoholic is. Self will run riot. God Almighty. Self will run riot. You admit you're powerless over alcohol, your life is unmanageable. Oh, you good thing that they made this program the way they did. They brought the second step right into play. Gave us something to believe in. So they can't believe the power greater than we are can restore us to sanity. I came to, and I came to believe that a power greater than we are can restore us to sanity. If you're standing in a bucket of crap, stand still. Don't start jumping up and down. Think your way out of it. That's being restored to sanity, see. A lot of people here tonight may not believe there's such a thing as a God. That's okay. He don't mind. It never seemed to bother him when I was running around saying, I don't know if there's a God or not. But I'll tell you one thing. He looked out on this planet one day and he says, you know, there's a gang of people on that planet that don't believe, that they won't listen to nobody. They won't listen to my preachers or my priests or my doctors or my psychiatrists or nobody. So the hell with them. I'll turn them loose on one another. And he started AA. That's how come we're here. So I learned to admit in the first step. And I came to believe in the second step. You should be ready for the third step if you've done those two. Made a decision to turn my life over to the care of God's understanding. Why in the hell did they say made a decision? You probably go to a church or something like this and say, go turn your life over to God. Give your life to God. Not here in AA. Hell no. Made a decision to turn your life over to the care of God as you understand Him. It's so that you think about what you're going to do. Because when you do it, and I believe this, I don't believe you drink again. And I'll tell you why. Stop and think about what you've just done. You made a decision to turn your life over to the care of God as you understand Him. I don't believe God's going to direct you down to a bar to get a drink. I don't believe He's going to direct you down to a liquor store to get a bottle either. I don't believe He's going to direct you to go out to anything and do anything wrong. I don't think He's going to tell you to go out doing to hurt your fellow man in any way. I don't think He's going to do that. So if you make that decision, turn your life over to the care of God as you understand Him, then you're able to go out and work and play and have fun and do all the things because your life and your will you don't have to worry about anymore. Willpower is something that I heard a man say one time. Guy asked him, why don't you use your willpower in connection with alcohol? He said, alcohol becomes soluble. Willpower becomes soluble in alcohol, just like sugar and water. Willpower becomes soluble in alcohol. How many times have you ever said to yourself, I will not drink again? Promised everybody, drink again. But I believe once a man turns his life over to the care of God, he understands, then he's got a head start. You think that'd be enough, but it isn't. No. They bring the fourth step. Made a fearless and searching moral inventory of myself. Fearless and searching. I've heard many guys say, had to go back and do it again. Well, that's when you stand in the middle of the room, you know, and sweep around circle. Don't get into the corners. Because fearless and searching means just that. It doesn't mean fearful and searchless. Fearless and searching, moral inventory of ourselves. Well, the fourth step is the great liberating step. That's the one that brings you eyeball to eyeball with yourself. A lot of guys say, well, I don't want to learn this about myself. I don't want to learn these things that I don't know. I say, you're not going to find a damn thing in the fourth step you don't already know. You're going to find a lot of things that I've been refusing to admit. The fourth step. How do you take it? Write your own life story. And don't write anybody else's. And don't flower it up. Just write yours. Don't add anything to it. Don't take anything away. And then you go to the fifth step. Go to some brown-eyed old man, tell him all about it. But you're already two-thirds of the way through the fifth step when you do the fourth. You've already told yourself and God. And the fifth step, you just go tell another man. A lot of people say, I don't want to do that. I don't know of anybody that does. But this is part of clearing away the wreckage of the past. So when I've done my fifth step, I'll tell you right now, it felt like a load had been lifted. And I think anybody else that ever done their fifth step feels the same way. And the sixth step says, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That means we can't remove them anyway. You know what you found out in the fourth step, and you admit it in the fifth step? That's what you're doing. What are the defects of character? Hell, they're very simple. Pride, number one. Ego, lust, anger, all these kind of things that we find in our fourth step. A lot of people say you're never supposed to be angry if you're an alcoholic. Well, I'll tell you something. If you don't want to blow the ears off the side of your head, you'd better once in a while. You keep on stuffing it, and I'll tell you right now, there ain't going to be no skin on your head. And no ears either. In fact, yes, you know, even in the Bible it shows that God talks about getting angry. You don't believe so? Look what he told Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, either clean up your act or I'll blow your ass off. And he did. Yeah. How about the time the carpenter was on the road to Damascus? And old St. Paul was riding along on his horse. He slapped him off his horse and blinded him for 3 days. He says, listen, you idiot, as I'm talking. You know what St. Paul did? He became a hell of a message carrier. Remember that? He carried a message from then on. Yeah. So all of these emotions that we have, all of these defects of character, all of these shortcomings, I still got every damn one I've ever had. And I was born with them, I guess. I've had them ever since I remember. I get mad, tell lies, cheat a little bit here and there. I don't know of any perfect human being. Lust, a lot of people get all tangled up in lust. A lot of people get tangled up in anger. A lot of people get tangled up in envy. You know, we all get tangled up in all these things, one or the other, something or other. So this is what it all talks about. Have God remove them. Seven steps is humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I had to go find out what shortcomings were. I found out what they were, too. Lying, cheating, all these kind of things that lead you back into defects of character and then finally back into a drunk. These are the things that we're talking about. This is the program. Alcoholics Anonymous. The 8 steps have made a list of all the people that harmed. Become willing to make amends to them all. That's all it does. It become willing and make the list. I used to sit down with that list. And I had some of those dirty rats on there. It did me more harm than I'd ever done them, I said. But that ain't what my sponsor said. Look, you clean off your side of the street to hell with theirs. So you make the list. And the 9th step says, go out and make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Go out and make direct amends. That means eyeball to eyeball where you can. Where it makes sense. Unless it's going to hurt them or somebody else. Don't ever salve your own conscience at the expense of somebody else. If you do, you're going to be living with it. So the ninth step, it's a very simple step. Just go out and make the amends. Because this is part of clearing away the wreckage of the past that we've been talking about. See, once I got through that ninth step, then I was a free man. I'd walk through that arc to freedom. I look back at my past now, and the swamp that I came out of, I never have to go back. It's there. It's a dirty, black past. But it's mine. It's my history. And what do you do about something that you can't change? I can't change an act, a word, or a deed. What do you do about something you can't change? You accept it. So I accepted Jack Holt. Turn him over to God. Here, take him, Father. He's too damn much for me. That's what we do. Now I'm free of that past. But I'm not ashamed of it anymore. It doesn't bother me anymore. You hear a lot of people talking about guilt. How in the name of God do you get rid of guilt, they say? I said, forgive yourself for what you've already done. And quit doing the things that make you feel guilty. Oh, but darn. Hell of a deal, huh? Yeah. Quit doing the things that make you feel guilty. That's the only way that I know. A lot of people, why is the guilt? How do you think God's going to get your attention? I have never yet, since I've been in this program, went out and did anything wrong that I wasn't first warned about it. And I'll tell you right now, that's what guilt's all about. You warn about it immediately. And the minute you commit it, immediately you got guilt. You pay the price right there standing on the spot. And you keep on paying it until you get rid of it. And the tenth step, seemed like this program says, well, now we've got them 9 steps. Now they've got them all cleaned up. But we've got to keep these alkies busy. We don't, they'll be drunk again. So they gave us a 10th step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And the word continue is like a circle. You won't find a beginning, and you won't find an ending. But it means the rest of my life. And thank God that I've got the rest of my life. Continue to take my personal inventory. When I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Promptly to me used to be 3 months. Then it became 3 weeks, 3 days, 3 hours. Now sometimes I can do it in 3 seconds, just like that. And that's great when I can do that. Sometimes with Alice, I've got to ponder it for a while. Don't know why, but I got to ponder it with her for a while. Strangers, most of the time I can just wham, hey, look, I'm fine, I goofed, I'm sorry. No big deal. Because as you learn in this program, you know, you stay in the engine of your train. You get out of the damn caboose. You get up in the engine, you know, where the action is. That's what we talk about. Action. Action in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the 10th step, well, I never have to go back and do the things I used to have to do. But I can take that 10th step and use it every day, and I do. Every night. Every night. And every morning. And every day at noon. Every day, that 10th step pops into my mind. Have I hurt anybody? Have I said anything bad about anybody? Have I criticized anybody? Have I been out gossiping about anybody? He's a hell of a gossiper, you know. We don't watch ourselves. Yickety, 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 Really? We're a hell of a family. You do something, somebody's going to know about it real quick. So damn it, 10th step tells not to do those things. Read it in the 12 of 12 where it talks about criticism, all this kind of stuff. So they give us a 10th step so we can stay busy taking our inventory. The 11th step says seek through prayer and meditation for closer conscious contact with God's understanding, praying only for knowledge of the will for me and the power to carry that out. Prayer. I used to have a hell of a time with prayer because it seemed like it took me a long time to talk to God. I had all kinds of prayers, and I said them by rote. You know, blah, 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 blah. He must have got tired. I don't know. Listening to me. But I come to find out, you know, you don't have to say a damn thing to pray. All you got to do is think about God. That is prayer. Thinking about God is prayer. So if you don't know how to pray, think about God. Think about the Word God. Think about the Word. A lot of guys say, well, how am I going to think about something I can't think, I can't see, I can't hear, I can't smell, I can't touch? I said, well, there's a lot of things that you can't do that with. One of them is the wind. You ever see the wind blowing through a tree? See the leaves rustling around, shaking up there? Do you see the wind? Hell no, but you see the result of it, don't you? So what do you look for? You look for the results of God in your life. And you see it. And better yet, you see it in somebody else's life. A lot quicker. You see the way it works. By the grace of God, there go I. You ever see a drunk laying on the street? By the grace of God, there could be me. But for the grace of God, there could be me. Meditation. How do you meditate? Think about God. That's all you got to do. I'll guarantee if you're thinking about Him, you're not be thinking about things. You got to be thinking about anything else. He's a little bit too big. And He's the kind of God that I come to understand is He's a good one. I know He gets amused at me a lot of times. But I like to say, I like to talk to Him just like I talk to you. I have a hell of a conversation in my car a lot of times. Especially if some driver isn't acting just right. But He is always around, you see. He's always there. I don't have to go out and look. You always hear people say, well, I got to go find God. Well, where the hell are you going to find Him at? Well, I don't know. But you can climb, you can go up into the mountains, you can go out on the sea, you can go any place you want to go. It was like the guy who wrote the poem, you know. He says, I sailed the broadest seas and I climbed the highest mountain. I even climbed the highest steeple. When I got all the way to the top, I found out that God was still down with the people. That's where He's at all the time, inside of you and I. So if you hurt another one of your human being friends, you're hurting your God. If you hurt Him, you hurt them. Next time you're about ready to hurt somebody, think about what you're going to do. Think about who you're going to hurt. And practically every time, you won't do it. Seek through prayer and meditation for a closer conscious contact. I've always had an unconscious contact with God because He kept me alive. If you don't believe there's a God, just when you go to sleep at night, what happens? I don't know. But He keeps my skin growing, my hair growing, my eyes seeing, my nails growing. You know, He keeps my bowels moving, all this. What the hell's going on? Tells me to get up when I gotta go, you know, in the night, in the middle of the night. Who does all this? I sure as hell don't. I'm unconscious. I don't know nothing. So who's going to do it? And we say, there's no God. Jeez. It's okay. I don't care if you want to believe that way. But I just stopped thinking of what's going on all that time when I'm asleep. What was going on all that time when I was drunk, passed out? Walking around like a zombie, a little, bloop, bloop, you know, and then knowing how I was. The love of this program. The greatness of this program and the greatness of the people that belong to it. You and I. We're great people, the alcoholics, let me tell you. So is the non-alcoholics. Any of you here tonight? I have a great admiration for non-alcoholics. Called Al-Anons. Wasn't for you, we wouldn't even be around. I'm married to one. Tough. Tough. She has to be tough. You got to be tough to stay with an alky. Because we lead you through strange places. The 12th step. Remember the little word here that I was talking about?
The answer is a little where it is in the first sentence of the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening. That's it. As a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Every one of you and I here tonight are message carriers. We became rag pickers a long time ago. The one that's been here a long time. You know what a rag picker is? You've read the book, some of you haven't. He's a guy that'll pick a human being off of the dung heap. Society has tossed him on the dung heap. He takes him up, he shakes him, and says, "You're worth something. You're of value. Wake up. Here's a way you can live without the use of alcohol or drugs. I don't like to have addicts get away with it either. I'm not an addict. I'm not a drug addict. I don't know what the hell I'm not. But I want to tell you one thing right now. You damned addicts are just as idiotic as we are. I know, but I sponsor some of these guys who've got what you call a dual problem. And screw you in hell, all of them. Goofy. But I love them. You see? Because they're part of us. I'm an alky. Lush. I don't know what it, I don't know anything about that other stuff except for one thing. It makes you crazy. But an alky, you can tell him a long ways away. You know, he stinks. He's usually obnoxious. He's yelling and bellowing and screaming. And he smells bad. All this kind of stuff, you know. He'll walk up to you, you know, and puke on you. So we have a mark. We have a great distinction the alky does when he's in his cups. You can see him and hear him a long ways away. But I see you other people. I'm telling you, I love you. And I know that you're looking for the same thing that we are. Sobriety. And sobriety isn't just staying sober. Man, I'm going to tell you right now, it is a hell of a lot more than that. If all I was in this program for was to stay sober, to hell with it, I'd left a long time ago. But man, this is life. We're living. We've been to hell and back several times. We've died a lot of times. And this program says you don't have to do it anymore. You never have to take another drink as long as you live, a day at a time. You can carry this message to other people. Come on, follow me. Be a rag picker. Pick one up. Get one under each arm. But with a drunk under each arm, I'll guarantee you, you won't take a drink. Because you can't build your elbows. And they will always remind you of where you come from. I always stay. I always keep some new ones around me. Because I'm still 12-stepping. And I love them. I really do. Some of them I don't like. But I love them. That's a fact. Practice these principles in all of my affairs? Never have I been able to. Never will I be able to, I don't think. And if I ever do, then what the hell? I'll be out walking on the water. But you know something? I don't really want to get that good yet. I'm like old St. Augustine says, God, give me grace, but not right now. I want to live. I want to be out in this life of ours. I want to live, and I want to live good. We're among the living. You've heard it. Faith without works is dead. I'm going to tell you right now, tonight, faith with works is alive right here in this place. Faith with works is alive. You know what faith is? Faith is just evidence of something you can't see. That's all it is. You can't even see the back of your head, you idiot, you know? You really can't even see your butt without a mirror. Yeah. Can't see, touch, hear. Wow, what the hell? You know. I have faith in a hell of a lot of things I can't see. You're damn right.
Gonna get better.
Jeez, this is great. Really. Spiritual progress. That's what you and I are doing. Progressing spiritually. Progressing spiritually. And this is what I want to do. Continue to progress spiritually. I quit blaming people, places, things, and circumstances a long time ago for what happens to me. I know the responsibility has been placed right where it belongs, right here, on my pinpointed little head. Right there. I'm responsible for the first drink. Always will be. Not God. Not society. Not the cops. Not the doctors. Not your wife. Not your job. Right up here that responsibility is. Right there. And don't ever take it off from there either. If you ever do, you'll be drunk. Because no one can take credit for your sobriety. No one can take credit for it. That's why no one can take it away from you. You can't lose it. You got to throw it away. And the longer I'm sober, the more I want to keep it. And the more I want to learn about it, the more I want to learn about living. And the way I learn about living is going to meetings, mingling with the people, from the top to the bottom. I don't give a damn where you come from. You put every one of us in a bar room and go back in 3 weeks, you wouldn't be able to tell the ones that had any money and the ones that didn't. You wouldn't be able to tell a Buddhist from a monk. You wouldn't be able to know. We'd all be drunk, stinking, and that'd be the way it'd be. So you see, we are a great people. We are a lovely people. We are of value. If you're here tonight, you don't put any value on yourself, I feel sorry for you. But if you walk up to a bar and you look in the back bar, and just before you take that drink, just stop and remember, the scale is balanced as long as you leave that ounce of whiskey on one side and your life, your wife, your kids, your clothes, your job, and everything else on the other. It'll stay balanced if you don't take that ounce of booze. If you take it, you all go down the sewer, and you with it. That's what we're dealing with. Cunning, baffling, powerful. We deal with alcohol in AA. We deal with it. We don't just talk about it. We deal with it. We deal with... You ever notice you don't deal with your problems, how quick they deal with you? You ever notice that? You hear somebody crying, me, God Almighty, say, you know, I've got anybody. Well, when you work last? You don't get jobs sitting at home by the phone waiting for it to ring. Pick it up and ring somebody else. You got to be on the attack side in this life. You got to be on the aggressive side. Go out and get them. Anytime you feel bad, just go out someplace and pick up a couple of drunks. They'll make you feel better real quick. They really will. And then they'll love you for it afterwards or hate you. I don't know which. Wow. It's getting better. I'm going to tell you right now. I have one story to tell. I'm going to shut this off. This Indian lived on the reservation. And he kept on getting drunk. And he was a young Indian. And the old chief told him, I'm going to kick you off this reservation if you don't quit getting drunk. Being an alcoholic, he got drunk again in 2 weeks. So he kicked him off. The old chief was sitting out in front of his teepee about 5 years later. He looked down the trail. He saw this dust coming up the trail. As it drew closer, he noticed an automobile in front of the dust. He drew right up and parked right in front of his teepee, and the old Indian was sitting out there cross-legged, his arms folded. It was a big, long, black limousine Cadillac. And the rear door opened. It was chauffeur-driven. The rear door opened, and this young buck stepped out that he'd kicked off the reservation 5 years before. The old Indian chief raised his hand in a normal Indian salutation. He says, "How?" Young guy says, chapter 5. Thank you. God bless you. And I'm glad with you. And I love you. Keep talking.
Thank you.